This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 10 years ago, readers of the Boston Globe opened the newspaper to a story that would rock one of the world's oldest and most powerful institutions to its core.
The date was January 6th, 2002.
The headline, Church Allowed Abuse by Priest for Years.
The Boston Globe spotlight team spent the next several years reporting the depth and breadth of the church's knowledge of the clergy sexual abuse crisis. They won a Pulitzer Prize for their efforts.
Over time, it became clear that this wasn't just a Boston story. The tragedy of power, abuse, and a crisis of faith proved to be an international one. But it was here that the story of the Catholic Church and sexual abuse received its first public reckoning. So we thought we'd go behind the scenes with two reporters from that original Globe team to hear the story of how they did it, what they learned, and what stayed with them a decade later. And one of those reporters is a familiar voice to WBUR listeners, Sasha Pfeiffer, host of WBUR's All Things Considered. She joined us from the Globe back in 2008. Sasha, thanks for trotting over from Studio One.
You're welcome.
We're also joined by Walter Robinson. He spent more than three decades at the Globe, and from 2000 to 2006, he served as assistant managing editor of the Spotlight team. He is now a distinguished professor of journalism at Northeastern, where he heads the school's investigative efforts. Walter Robinson, welcome back to you.
Thanks very much, Meghna.
Well, listeners, let me throw some questions out for you. What is your question for these two journalists? What do you think the impact was of the Globe's reporting on the clergy sexual abuse crisis, the impact on Boston, on the church, and on Catholicism itself? And why do you think the reckoning happened here? And what more do you want to know about it? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Now, Sasha and Walter, if I could, I went back and read that 2002 coverage, and I just want to start with the first paragraph or two of that January 6th report because, well, I just want to read it to listeners. The story began, since the mid-1990s, more than 130 people have come forward with horrific childhood tales about how former priest John J. Gagan allegedly fondled or raped them during a three-decade spree through a half-dozen greater Boston parishes. Almost always, his victims were grammar school boys. One was just 4 years old. Then came last July's disclosure that Cardinal Bernard F. Law knew about Gagan's problems. So there it is, the entire crisis, basically in a nutshell, in that first story that the Spotlight team wrote. What was it in the months preceding the publication of that story that made you think there was something worth pursuing here?
Well, it wasn't our idea. Our investigative team focused mostly on things like corrupt politicians, greedy judges, that's no-show public employees. And in the summer of 2001, the Globe got a new editor, Marty Baron, and it's a great benefit of having a fresh pair of eyes. On his first day, he came into a news meeting and had seen an Eileen McNamara column the day before that wrote about the civil suits against Gagan and noted that the judge had sealed all the records.
There were 84 lawsuits against him at the time.
And Marty raised the question, well, why should these be sealed? Shouldn't we go to court and ask that they be unsealed? Doesn't the public have a right to know this? And that same day, he asked me, as the editor of the Spotlight team, to have the team investigate Father Gagan. So we were essentially on parallel tracks. Our lawyers were in court, unknown to anybody else in the news media, and we were very quickly looking into Father Gagan. And we, of course, like reporters approaching a subject they know nothing about, we were a bit frantic, would you say, Sasha?
I agree.
And so we called everybody we could think of. Mm-hmm. And we began our own sort of two-track reporting on Gagan on the one hand, because there were records eventually going to come due. But very quickly, within 3 or 4 weeks, we learned that there were at least several dozen other priests who had done the same thing and it had been covered up.
Was that the point at which you took a step back as a team, or you were in the newsroom looking at each other and you thought, there's a lot more to this than we thought?
I think so. You know, it started out as, this will sound cliched, but it started out as sort of, what did people know and when did they know it? And it became very clear very early on that many people in very high up places in the church had known for quite a long time that this was going on. And I think what we began to focus on was not a story about priests who abuse children, but a story about church higher-ups who covered up for priests who abused children. That was really, I think, the difference in terms of what we set out to do and what previous reporters had done.
You know, the Globe went to court to get those records unsealed, as you were mentioning. And eventually, obviously, you won that case to get those records. It sounds, on the one hand, really dreary to get boxes and boxes and boxes of court records or church records and go through them. But on the other hand, you know, how did it start emerging to you the complexity of this picture? Like, what did you do to put all the pieces together?
Well, as I say, by the time we published our first story in January of 2002, we had the court order. We didn't yet have the records. One of our colleagues, Mike Resendez, great reporter, had found other Gagin records on his own. So the first stories were built upon those records. When we got the 10,000 pages later in January of Gagin's records, I think we had less than 36 hours to turn that into this extraordinary, lengthy number of stories that took up, I think, 6 or 8 clear pages inside the Globe.
And when we finally did get boxes and boxes of thousands of files, that was a mother load. But up until then, we were just working with a church that had no interest at all in telling us what. We often tell people this story that we had at one point given the church a call and said, we have a list of questions we'd like to give you. And the church not only didn't want to answer our questions, it didn't want to see our questions. So we had a church that was unwilling to engage in any way. We had cases that were sealed, and so lawyers who were often settling these cases quietly had no interest in talking. It had become quite a cash cow, really, for some lawyers doing this. Victims who were often quite embarrassed and ashamed and didn't want to talk. So we had to just begin to piece together little bits of information, and eventually we were able to piece it together and realize that we had quite a story on our hands.
Walter, I mean, Sasha was telling me a little earlier when we were preparing for this segment that some of the investigation that you had to do was, again, it sounds pretty dreary, like, you know, making huge Excel spreadsheets and trying to match priest names with parish assignments over time and seeing if a pattern emerged.
Well, you know, since we had no access to the church, and by the way, I have to say that the fact that the Archdiocese said to us, we don't even want to know what your questions are. Mm-hmm. We put that very high in our very first story because we wanted to let the readers know that the mindset was that the church felt it did not need to be accountable to anybody in the public world. But one of the things we did, and I look back on it, and it really was drudgery. We knew that Father Gagin and 4 or 5 other priests whom we had developed files on had all been placed kind of on the shelf by the church. They were listed as awaiting assignment, assigned to the clergy personnel office, sick leave. And we said, you know, this is an archdiocese that's down to 700 priests. They can't afford to have people on the shelf. So we basically took their annual directory of priests and their assignments, and we went through it for 19 years, and every priest who was ever out on sick leave or awaiting assignment, we put him into a database, and then we tracked every year of his assignment. And within, I'd say, 2 months before we published, we had a database of close to or over 100 priests.
I can remember actually sitting in the office with these basically phone books in my lap, fine print phone books going alphabetically through the priests. We would call out who they were, where they worked, what year it was, and what their status was. And then we would create these databases so you could track priests over a 19, 20-year period. And oftentimes they would be at a parish for a long time, and suddenly they were on medical leave. Eventually, as we did our reporting, that medical leave assignment often tracked with when a victim would have complained to the church. And as we now know, the church would often yank the priest out of the parish, put them perhaps temporarily on medical leave, and then maybe quietly later put them back in circulation on the North Shore instead of the South Shore. Pre-internet era, very hard to find out where that priest was.
I'm talking to Sasha Pfeiffer. She's currently host of WBUR's All Things Considered. She's a former member of the Globe Spotlight team, and also to Walter Robinson. He was the editor of the Spotlight team from 2000 to 2006. He is now a professor at Northeastern University. And we're talking about basically the behind-the-scenes story on how the Boston Globe reported the clergy sex abuse crisis 10 years ago. We're at 1-800-423-8255. 855. That's 800-423-TALK. Sasha and Walter, I've got to ask you. So you did the drudgery of getting court records, getting church records, going through them line by line and trying to understand what was going on. But then you also went out into the world and spoke with victims of abuse and also priests themselves. What were some of those early meetings like with some of the priests or victims?
I remember very early on meeting with a man who at the time must have been in his 50s, and he had been abused when he was in his late teens, early 20s. I think we were at a Chili's restaurant, maybe in Quincy or Braintree, and this man just cried and cried and cried at that table. And I can remember the waitress sort of trying to avoid coming to our table and other people wonder what was going on. But oftentimes, people were telling us their stories for the very first time. And there was a certain, I think, openness in society that made people more willing to talk about it than they had been, say, 10 or 20 years before. I also remember at one point when we were publishing, someone came forward who had been abused by a priest at BC High, and this man had not yet told his wife, but he said, "I want to go public. I want my name in the paper." And I remember saying to him, "You really need to tell your wife before she opens up the paper in the morning and tells you." So we ended up in many ways, as my former boss here would say, in a counseling role, really. And it hit us pretty hard to see the impact that remained decades sometimes after this incident happened.
You know, when Amanda, when we started to publish, we put a fairly prominent box with each story, as the Spotlight team at that point had done for 2 or 3 years, saying, if you have information you'd like to share on this subject, here's our phone number, here's our confidential tip line, here's our email address. And what happened is we had over 300 victims just in the Boston Archdiocese contact us in the next several weeks. And as Sasha said, we ended up in what for us was a somewhat uncomfortable counseling role. But we had many of these victims who'd lived with this for 20, 30, 40 years. We had one victim who was 87. And we were, in many cases, we were the first person they had ever told. Mm-hmm. About their abuse. They had never talked to their parents about it or their siblings, and in the case Sasha mentioned, and another I can think of, had told their wives. And what happened, obviously, over time, as more and more of these people came forward, number one, we said, well, what priest abused you? And they would give us the name of a priest, and most often that priest was in our database that we had.
Or, and I also credit the internet with this, is that once we began publishing stories and some priests' names were in the newspaper, we began getting calls from all over the country. So one man would call from Alaska and someone from Florida and someone from Missouri, and they would all say, "Father Tom Birmingham did this to me at this time here." And all these stories matched up. People who really couldn't possibly have coordinated their stories. And suddenly this web began to come together.
Well, there's a question that's on radioboston.org that I want to throw to you because it's apropos of this point. Stacey M. writes on our website, "I grew up on the South Shore, and the idea that there was a problem and a cover-up was common knowledge. The real question to the reporters, what took you so long?"
Well, so, you know, it's so interesting because when we began to publish our stories, I remember getting a few calls from people who said, "Do you really think you're actually exposing anything new? We all knew not to let our kids with certain priests on weekend ski trips and so forth." But what people weren't realizing was not everyone knew, because the families that were usually targeted, and there was a profile of a targeted family, was often a broken family, a single mother, a mother overwhelmed by taking kids alone, who was very grateful for a priest who would offer any help and often wasn't aware that this priest might be a predator. And so some people had a sense that they needed to keep their kids away from some priests, but many people very, very much didn't.
Well, I'm sorry to interject there, Walter, but I do want to ask, because eventually, the church did respond in that first week or so, because a couple days after the first story came out, the Globe printed a transcript from Cardinal Law, basically, you know, headlined "Apology for Gagan Abuse" with Q&A. So you finally got access to Cardinal Law.
The Cardinal had a news conference in which he apologized, in which he also said that the Cardinal was blameless because they had relied on the opinions of two doctors that he could go back to work. So they sent him to another parish. Well, it turns out that one of the doctors was a family friend and a general practitioner who knew about as much about sex abuse as you or I, and the other was a psychiatrist who himself had been accused of sexually abusing his patients. And I think I look to that story, which we came out with a couple of days later, as the story that really undermined the cardinal's support among major Catholic figures in Boston. Because he offered his explanation and his apology, and very quickly it was undermined by the facts.
So a journalistic question for both of you, because, I mean, the story is so explosive, so massive. Walter, as editor, how did you manage or handle the reporting that was coming in so that, you know, people didn't turn around, or actually, you know, some people still nevertheless did turn around and say, the Globe is on a witch hunt, the Globe is anti-Catholic, the Globe is being sensationalist?
Well, you know what? I think we avoided the sensationalist tag because, as Sasha already mentioned, our focus from the beginning was, yes, we focused on the crimes, but we focused most of our reporting attention on the extent to which the church knew, facilitated the abuse, and covered it up for decades. And I think that's really what mattered to people. And the second thing is, we expected, since the Cardinal's relationship with the Globe had been horrible for years, mm-hmm. that we would have a fair number of people protesting in front of the Globe. And that never happened. And the reason it never happened is because we had their documents. And that was so critical, because the documents told the truth about what the church knew.
Two things I want to add. One is that at one point I had gone out to this assisted living facility, I think in Framingham or Natick, that had took many retired priests. And I went out to talk to this priest about John Gagan, who many priests called Jack. And I remember this priest saying to me, "We all knew that Jack fooled around with little boys." And he kind of dismissed it. And I remember thinking, fooled around with little boys is such a euphemism. It's such a way to sanitize what happened. And we would often have discussions in the Spotlight team about what a range of things to be molested means. Without being too graphic, it can be a much less physical but very traumatic thing, and it can be incredibly physical. And we found ourselves wanting to be very careful about getting across to readers just how what kind of impact this has when it happens to you when you're 12, 13 years old, mm-hmm. and in this key stage of sexual development, but not be accused of being salacious or overly explicit. So we were very careful about that. So, you know, we thought through very carefully how to get across impact without trying to open ourselves up to those kind of accusations.
Let's take a quick call from Darlene, who's calling from Natick. You're on the air, Darlene.
Thanks for taking my call, and I'm very grateful to the Globe people for doing the grunt work that was necessary to make this happen. I had a neighbor back in the early 90s who worked for the diocese, and she worked in the area that handled people who were doing sex abuse. And she would come and tell me these stories that would literally have me gagging and wanting to throw up. I tried to contact every newspaper in New England to get somebody to do something about it. I couldn't get a response from anybody. Nobody answered my letters. Nobody answered my information. Finally, I wrote to the National Enquirer, figuring maybe they'd pay attention to me. Nobody did, and I remember saying to this woman, "Why won't anybody listen about this?" And she looked at me and she said, "Because nobody wants to listen. Nobody wants to hear about it. Everybody just wants people to shut up." And what's interesting is it wasn't just an organization that handled the part about sex abuse with children. There were priests having affairs with married women, married congregants, and producing children.
Darlene, thank you so much for your call. Sort of just a dovetail with what Darlene was saying, Walter Robinson, it should be noted that there was some reporting about this issue, I mean, in part because there were those 84 civil cases against John Gagan before the Spotlight team started producing its series. There was some great reporting in the Boston Phoenix. Jason Berry, who was then with the LA Times, was writing quite significantly about sex abuse in the church as well. Why do you think the Globe's reporting seems to be the one that resonated?
Well, first of all, stories about Gagan and his ilk were not uncommon in newspapers. When I say his ilk, there had been, since the mid-'80s, a half dozen celebrated cases around the country of individual priests who had molested many, many children. And we had one right here in the Fall River Diocese in Massachusetts, Father mm-hmm. James Porter. And that story consumed a lot of reporting resources at the Globe in 1991 and 1992. So it wasn't new. Well, but the story, and I feel badly that Darlene couldn't reach anyone, but back then, the church very skillfully was able to persuade the public through the news media that, well, this was a single case of one aberrant priest, and there are hardly any others. And we're no different than any other institution that cares for children. So there had been a lot. Gagan had been a story since 1995 and 1996. Mm-hmm. Our former colleague David Armstrong had done a major story in 1997 about the allegations against Gagan, and then the Phoenix in 2001. So what made what we did different is that we got to the answer to the question.
Right. Sasha, we've just got a couple minutes left, so I want to close with one last question for you. It's been 10 years. Over that past decade, what stayed with you the most?
What stayed with me the most, I think, was a very clear thing, which is the number of very talented, articulate, smart, capable men I talked to. And again, they were really all men who were in their 50s, 60s, 40s, and were stuck in time. And the time was basically when they were an adolescent and when this terrible thing happened to them and they could not move beyond it.
These are victims.
Victims, yes. Something, this sort of physical, sexual thing happened involving a priest, and it made it difficult for them to have healthy relationships ever again. And that was really hard to see. I also want to add that we wrote a book about this later, mm-hmm. and there was a chapter called The Decline of Deference, and this gets at the poster on your website who wrote What Took So Long, and Darlene's question about why won't anyone do anything. Remember, Boston in the 50s and 60s worshipped Catholic Church. It still has a large role in the city, but not like the 50s and 60s, and people were very reluctant to ask questions of that organization, to question authority. That was another lesson I learned. It sounds cliched, but question authority, because when you don't, this kind of thing happens.
How times have changed. Well, on that note, we've got a comment from Wallace M4444 on radioboston.org who says, I was a priest abuse victim in the 1960s that still hasn't come out. I wonder how many more are still out there. Well, Sasha Pfeiffer, host of WBUR's All Things Considered, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And great work today, as every day.
Thank you.
And Walter Robinson, a former managing editor of the Globe Spotlight team and current professor of journalism at Northeastern. Great to have you as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, let us know what you think, as always, on our website, radioboston.org. Up next, the kick scene around the world, or at least here in New England. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.